Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Need another reason to hate your cell phone company? Try this. Verizon's coming out with a new data plan. We'll tell you all about that. Also, a man walks into a bar and says, "What's up, Europe?" From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 12th of June. Good to have you with us. So there's all this buzz out there about mobile technology, right? Has been for a while now, about how that's where all the real money's going to be. You know what has to come first, though, before advertising or mobile marketing or any of that? Data. Data plans, to be specific. And if what phone companies offer now isn't confusing enough, wait till you hear what Verizon Wireless announced today. The carrier is going to drop nearly all of its data plans and replace them with a new scheme that encourages people to share what's essentially a bucket of data among their various smartphones and laptops and tablets. Verizon says most customers will end up paying the same or less. Analysts say, come on, really? Here's Marketplace's Bob Moon.
Here's the deal. Instead of buying separate wireless plans for your smartphone, laptop, and iPad, Verizon will be offering unlimited talk and text plus a data plan you can share among different devices. You can buy 1 gigabyte per month for $50. 10 gigabytes will cost $100.
In a world where consumers are talking less and less on the phone, carriers want to protect the revenue that they get.
Forrester research analyst Charles Golvin also sees this as a way to simplify consumer options. Most Verizon customers will be able to keep their current plans, but newer customers will find some choices eliminated. Tammy Irwin is chief marketing officer at Verizon Wireless.
If I'm a new customer beginning on the 28th, these will be the only plans that are available for a new customer to purchase.
CNET senior writer Maggie Reardon says many individual users will have no choice but to pay more for their increasingly important data connections because of the way the new plans are structured.
I'm getting more voice, which I don't need, and I'm getting less data, which I'm going to need a lot of, and I'm probably going to need more of it in the future.
Already, AT&T has said it expects to implement its own shared data plans, and Forrester's Charles Golvin says other providers will almost certainly follow.
The basic model of here's a bunch of data that you can attach different devices to and we'll deduct bits from that pool, I believe that that model is the model of the future, and we'll see it from all the carriers.
Golvin says those wireless providers might charge a little differently, but he says the days of cheap, unlimited data plans are over. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Here's another technology story, this one of the political kind. 2012 has been, as you know, the year of the super PAC of millionaires and billionaires giving freely as they like to support the candidates of their choice. Well, enter now the small contributor. This week, the Federal Election Commission said candidates for federal office can accept donations via text messages. Marketplace's David Gura explains why and how those who give by text might be giving campaigns something even more valuable than just cash.
Politicians took notice when Americans used their cell phones to donate after the earthquake in Haiti and the tsunami in Japan. This would work a lot like that. You'd text how much you want to give to a number, you'd confirm that amount, and that charge would show up on your phone bill. Aaron Smith is a researcher at the Pew Center.
You don't need a bank account. You don't need a credit card. You don't need to, you know, type in a long string of numbers to do this. It's a very sort of seamless process.
But a small donation to a political campaign would get even smaller by the time that process is over with, maybe smaller by half. Wireless carriers would take a cut, and there'd be a middleman to process the payment and to comply with FEC rules. But telecom analyst Derek Curtin says something else makes up for those fees.
You leave that little calling card, which is your cell phone number, every time you donate.
Or as one of the guys who pushed for this, Democratic political consultant Mark Armour puts it,
once someone texts a donation, they opt in.
And the donor winds up on the campaign's list.
Both for persuasion or for further fundraising.
The campaign could send text messages and it could make phone calls asking for more money. But Bert Johnson, a Middlebury College political science professor, says it gives them a way to make another kind of request.
Could you please text your friend right now and tell them that this rally is taking place or that you need to get out to the polls?
And that ability to get out the vote may be the most valuable thing a campaign can ask for. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders turned the other cheek to the European debt crisis. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Remember all the stories a couple of years ago about people stealing copper? They were breaking into construction sites and utility company storage facilities and stealing copper by the pound. Well, here's the new version of that story. There's a growing trend of beauty supply store break-ins. They don't want the cash or extra conditioner. They came for the hair. Jim Burris reports from WABE in Atlanta.
Lexi's Beauty Supply isn't a big store, but the long, dark, silky lock of hair owner Madeline Roberts holds in her hand is big business.
This is the top of the line hair. It's very expensive. Just this piece right here, this is probably 22 inches. That right there is going to run about $160, $170.
You'll need two for a full weave. That's more than $300. Hair extensions are still in vogue. That's largely why Roberts opened her shop here less than a year ago.
New from overnight, police say some bold thieves slammed a stolen car into a store.
The thieves were after only one thing, bundles of hair.
And then they stole $10,000 worth of weave.
Even then, there were often stories about burglars hitting hair weave shops. They all kind of played out the same way. A U-Haul truck plows through a glass storefront, then masked men jump out and head right for the hair.
We knew that robberies were going on, and burglaries, I should say, were going on all over Atlanta for the hair. But you just don't think on such a main street across from a 24-hour McDonald's, you just don't think they're going to be that bold.
They were. 3 weeks after opening, bandits threw a brick through the front window. They were in and out in a minute. The burglary cost Roberts about $6,000.
And the heck of it is that in the first couple of months that we were open, we left the lights on like this all night. So it was very bright in here. So they were bold.
Major Randall Robinson of the Atlanta Police Department agrees the perpetrators are bold. He says officers had just gotten a hand on a similar string of thefts. Those involved blue jeans. Then the hair weave heist started.
And then it was like, wow, they're taking hair weave.
Major Robinson sees hair as just the next hot commodity.
Criminals decided, well, hey, if we can tap into that market, this is a way for us to do it.
Hair weaves are nearly impossible to track, so crooks often pull up to a local park, open the trunk, and quickly sell their goods. And unlike drugs, police can't arrest someone just for having a lot of hair in their car. Hair thefts aren't just an Atlanta thing. In the past year, crooks have gotten away with $10,000 worth in San Diego. A Houston salon lost $150,000 in one break-in.
She wants something more dramatic.
Back at Lexi's Beauty Supply, owner Madeline Roberts has given her store a makeover. She's installed bulletproof glass and hired a security guard. That's what police call target hardening. And the only hair left at the store overnight are extensions called Yaki. They're only $20 a package.
If they want to go to jail over cheap hair, that's on them.
At least four hair thieves have gone to jail. Apparently, they were so focused on the smash and grab, they didn't notice the cop working security at the Waffle House next door. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
There comes every now and then an economic report that makes you go, wait, what? Today is one of those days. The Federal Reserve does a survey of consumer finances every 3 years, the most recent of which came out yesterday. And it shows median income was down almost 8%, which makes sense given the recession. But there is one nugget that has economists scratching their heads. Turns out the more money and the more education that you had, the bigger your losses. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
Just to make clear, we're not talking about net worth, like houses, yachts, or land. We're talking income, like from a paycheck. And according to the Fed's latest survey, incomes among the American middle class dropped the most during the recession. The bottom 25% of earners fell too, but by much less. Timothy Smeeting at the University of Wisconsin says the poor had less to lose, of course, but he says the public safety net was what really helped them weather the recession, especially aid like food stamps.
You only need to be poor to get it, and many states have eased access to the program such that it provides a real stabilizer.
But what about low-income Americans who weren't collecting public assistance? They didn't lose as much ground as the college-educated middle either.
That's the puzzle. Many of them might have moved in with someone else because they couldn't afford their own apartment anymore. Some of them probably, you know, I don't know. That's the best answer I've got there. I'm sorry.
Smeeting says he and other economists have been emailing and texting about this puzzle all day. We caught NYU economist Ed Wolf on his cell phone. He suspects the income numbers are skewed somewhat by all those recent grads stuck working part-time at the Gap.
I don't think this is a long-term situation. I think eventually college graduates will get back into their usual relatively high-paying jobs.
Timothy Smeeting says this week's Fed report should not discourage Americans from getting a BA. College grads still make more money overall, that is, when they have a job. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
We had a listener post a picture on Marketplace.org the other day. It's a man holding his head in his hand, sitting next to an ATM. We thought it was interesting, so we called the guy who sent it in. Jacques is his name. He lives in New Jersey, and we asked him about it.
Well, I was walking along the street of Manhattan, and I passed an ATM outlet, and I saw the individual in there. And he could be homeless, but he could be anyone, basically, who's going through a difficult time in his life. This photo captured the irony that we had money to bail out big banks, hundreds of billions of dollars, but millions of people suffering out there, many millions still unemployed. And actually, I am unemployed myself.
Out of a job for close to 2 years now. He says, used to be in pharmaceuticals, processing FDA compliance documents. He doesn't think, he told us, that he's going to get another job doing the same thing. So he's starting graduate school online this July. He's getting an MBA. Coming up.
It's a high-tech activity tracker that's no bigger than a thumb drive. You wouldn't even notice it on my waistband, but it's come to dominate my world.
Health conscious or a little obsessed? But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street rode the seesaw back to the upside today by roughly the same margin it lost yesterday. The Dow Industrials bounced 162 points higher, nearly 1.3%, 12,573. The Nasdaq rallied 33 points, around 1.2%, 2843. The number, the S&P 500 added 15 points, also 1.2%, 1324 at the bell. Financial shares floated back up. Stock in Citigroup and Morgan Stanley deposited more than 4%. Shares of Bank of America and JPMorgan Chase both rose nearly 3% today. Michael Kors was in fashion with investors. Get it? Kors in fashion. Thanks to quarterly profits that more than doubled, the stock stitched up a gain of more than 7.5%. Bond prices slipped. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.66%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the producer price index for May. The Commerce Department issues its monthly retail sales report. And 46 years ago, on June 13th, the U.S. Supreme Court established the Miranda warning. Suspects must be informed of their rights before statements can be taken by police. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, here's today's second economic news can be baffling story. There's some new data out today that shows state tax revenues are expected to climb to their highest levels in 5 years. given the growing but still completely sluggish economy. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer to find out for us how that can be.
The report is based on a survey of state budgets for fiscal 2013, and it shows they're expecting tax revenue to go up by about 4%, the biggest tax take since the recession started. Why is more money flowing into state piggy banks? More people are working and paying state income taxes, and they're starting to spend again, boosting state sales taxes. Those are the biggies.
And then there are other taxes for things like gasoline or corporate taxes, and they've all gone up recently as well.
That's Howard Cure, an economist at Evercore Wealth Management. What will the states do with their extra cash? Scott Pattison heads the National Association of State Budget Officers, which did the survey, along with the National Governors Association. Pattison says the states should behave like prudent consumers.
I look at this as a state being someone who receives a modest bonus, and they're not really able to go on vacation, but they can use it to pay down their credit cards.
The state's biggest bills for education and Medicaid. But fiscal prudence is problematic. Therese McGuire is an economist at Northwestern University.
In the good times, as the revenues start flowing in, a lot of states have the tendency to just spend every dime that comes in.
But the state's tax windfall still isn't up to boom time levels. McGuire says maybe that's a good thing. It would be just too tempting for states to dive off a fiscal cliff again. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The hockey season's done. As you may have heard, the Los Angeles Kings won the Stanley Cup last night, which leaves basketball with the only playoff games in town. The NBA Finals start this evening, the Miami Heat versus the Oklahoma City Thunder. And while the spotlight will undoubtedly shine on LeBron James and Kevin Durant, we couldn't help but take note of a couple of not-so-stellar performers. The companies whose names are on the arenas where the games are going to be played. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
People have called it the stadium curse when naming rights go wrong. A company spends millions to put their brand on a stadium and then goes bust. Michael Leeds is a sports economist at Temple University.
Enron Field in Houston is always a delight.
There's also CMGI, which wanted its name tied to the New England Patriots.
And the company went bust before the stadium was even finished being built.
The list goes on. And now in this NBA Finals matchup, Miami Arena's namesake, American Airlines, is in bankruptcy. And the Thunder are playing in an arena named after the very troubled Chesapeake Energy. But Leeds says we might want to back away from all the curse and jinx talk, as tempting as it might be for us sports fans. He's researched stadium naming rights.
We generally found that they really did not have much of an effect at all on the profitability of the company.
But what about the effect on the players of being tied to a down-in-the-dumps corporation? I call up Galen Clavillo. He's a sports management professor at Indiana University.
And based on the trouble the two companies are in, American and Chesapeake, any handicapping we can do for the finals?
No, fortunately, they're not having any impact on the actual play on the floor.
He says players just don't care all that much about arena names. As for winners and losers?
If you were matching the corporations up against one another, I think you definitely take American Airlines over Chesapeake.
But in the basketball series, he's betting on Oklahoma. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Today was, by recent measures, fairly quiet in the European debt crisis. There is perhaps a creeping realization that this weekend's Spanish bailout might not be enough. But otherwise, it was a perfect day to saunter the streets, stop someplace for a drink, and strike up a conversation.
A man walks into a bar, he says, "Give me a Bacardi and Coke."
Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on a grand tour of European bars this week, seeking not official pronouncements on the debt crisis, but the view from a bar stool. He stops today in Paris.
The Café La Fusée is a short walk away from Paris City Hall.
My name is Benjamin Scott. I am the co-owner of Café La Fusée.
Benjamin Scott is an unusual Parisian. He's mild-mannered and friendly. But his café bar on the right bank of the Seine is typically French. The red and white striped awning, the menu chalked up on a blackboard. And Benjamin's explanation for the crisis is typically French too.
It's more about the people who likes to earn money without working, who like to speculate.
Benjamin cannot accept that the Eurozone is at fault.
You don't blame the euro for this mess, then?
No, the euro is just a currency, money. It's a name on a money. It can't be the fault of a money.
Benjamin says that despite the financial turmoil in Europe, his business and many others here are doing fine.
Un croque monsieur, une tarte provençale, s'il te plaît.
His customers seem to be doing okay too, although 22-year-old David Carasso, who will graduate soon from a business school, is getting nervous.
We are fearing that the same situation that's happening in Spain right now, 40% of students are unemployed in Spain, and it could happen in France, and we know it. We are not different from Spain.
Last week, the Minister for Labour in France's new socialist government promised to tackle unemployment. How? By making it too expensive for companies to lay off staff.
Merci beaucoup. Bonne journée.
At La Fusée, more customers come and go. The early summer sunshine begins to fade. The mood in the bar darkens a little too. The news coming in from other Eurozone countries like Spain and Greece never seems to get any better. Eddie Adayi, a pharmacist, drinks a coffee after work, and he says he's worried that Greece might be pushed out of the euro.
After that, you have another country. I don't know, maybe Portugal or Spain. You open the door to breaking up the Eurozone.
To break the Eurozone.
For the Eurozone to break up?
Yeah.
I didn't find a single drinker in La Fusée who thought breaking up would be a good idea. 63-year-old teacher Raymond Legendre.
We need a union. It's not possible to have Germany and France and Italy separated.
As separate countries?
Yes. No. I think it's the past.
But how much more closely would she like to rub shoulders with her European partners?
Would you like to see, eventually, a United States of Europe?
Yes, but it's a dream. It needs a long time.
You say it's a dream, it's a nightmare, isn't it?
No, not a nightmare. No, it's a dream.
A nice dream.
I wish that.
She's still in a minority.
Quand il se balade pas sur toi, je ne sais que faire de mes doigts.
With Serge Gainsbourg crooning in the background, with Red Bordeaux and Croque Monsieur on the menu, there seems little appetite here for less France and more Europe. But if the euro is to survive, more Europe and a more dominant role for Germany could be on the way. At La Fusée in Paris, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
I saw an article the other day talking about the quantified self, people using technology to track the slightest little things about themselves, how many steps they take in a day, how many hours of REM sleep they've gotten, anything at all. Gadgets you can wear and apps for your smartphone have turned it all into a pretty good-sized industry, one not without a downside or two, though, as commentator Beth Titel explains.
Am I better off knowing that in the course of one evening, while packing for a trip to Southern California, I went up and down the stairs 70 times? That's to the basement to wash multiple loads because somehow all of our presentable clothing was dirty? To the kitchen to make sandwiches that my kids would later shun in favor of pricey in-flight offerings? To the attic to hunt for sandals that would turn out to be too small anyway? And I mean literally 70 times. I know because I was wearing my new Fitbit. It's a high-tech activity tracker that's no bigger than a thumb drive. You wouldn't even notice it on my waistband, but it's come to dominate my world. On days I don't walk enough, I've caught myself saying, Fitbit is not going to be happy, as if the $100 gadget is my supervisor in a sales job. It's compensation based on my success. My husband and I, partners in the rest of life, are now locked in a Fitbit competition to see who can amass more steps. I'm fantasizing about secretly hiring a Fitbit walker who could spend days strolling around wearing my device, earning miles from me while I relax on the couch. And on the way back from that trip to California, when we got to LAX and learned that our flight was delayed by 3 hours, other passengers were despondent, but not me. I cheerfully circled gates 40 through 49. Who cares about getting home at 1 a.m. on a school night if it means you get to feed your Fitbit? Everyone I know who self-tracks in this way loves all the monitoring. They've started taking the stairs at work. They're meeting friends for walks instead of a cup of coffee. Imagine the healthcare savings if the whole country could become so obsessed. But me, I almost think I've taken the whole counting thing too far. I've gotten to the point where I don't even feel that I've worked out unless Fitbit is there to measure my efforts. It's the modern version of the old question about a tree falling in the woods, I guess. If a woman spends an entire day walking around the San Diego Zoo with her children, but forgot to charge her Fitbit, did she get any exercise?
Beth Tytel writes for the Boston Globe. Her most recent book is called Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, tomorrow's news today, if you will. JPMorgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon is going to take a turn at the long green witness table in front of the Senate Banking Committee in the morning, trying to explain that $2 billion loss from a couple of weeks ago. The committee's title for the hearing gives you some sense as to how it's going to go. A breakdown in risk management. It's called What Went Wrong at JPMorgan Chase. Dimon released his own testimony late this afternoon ahead of the hearing. It reads, in part, "We've let a lot of people down and we're sorry for it," end quote. He says, by the way, he expects Chase to be solidly profitable this quarter. Our New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore, is in D.C. for those goings-on. She'll be back with us tomorrow. Let us know what happened. All right, that's it. We got to go. Today, the Dow up 162 points, almost 1.3%. The Nasdaq rebounded 33 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 tacked on 15 points, about 1.1% there. Thanks to Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Justin Ho, and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Bead. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.